Okay, guys, welcome to Gotosis Sales 101. So if you're listening to this, that means you are taking the certification course to become a salesperson at Gotosis. This series is being recorded from my beautiful garden here in sunny Surrey during the coronavirus lockdown, so this will carbon date this for you if you're listening to this in a few years. This series is designed to help you to understand, first of all, our core client base, the kind of value that our clients derive from our solutions, and primarily to put you in a place where you can understand the pain that they feel, can therefore communicate the value of our solutions to them down the road. A little bit further on, we will go into some of the finer points around the functionality and how that ties in to that derivation of value. But we're going to start out by talking about the clients themselves. So our core client base is mostly made up of asset managers. So if you know what an asset manager is, and you know how the financial services industry works, in particular the investment industry, then feel free to skip ahead to the next chapter. But I think it's very important that anyone who is coming into Gotosis as a client-facing team member has that appreciation of how our clients do business, how they make money, how they help their customers, and everything that they do. So starting out with asset management, what is asset management? You could say it's one of the oldest industries in the world. It's of course the industry in our world that invests capital on behalf of individuals, so people like you or I, organizations, entities, corporate pension plans would be a good example of that. But of course, an endowment of a university would also be another type of institution. Now, the actual investment industry is made up of many different participants. But when you boil it all down, it is money being taken to invest, to buy assets, to lend, and with the idea that over time, those assets are going to appreciate in value, hopefully faster than inflation, and then provide more capital at the end of the investment period than at the start. And so, of course, being a sophisticated industry, there's lots of different ways in which that capital flows through to the asset manager. But of course, the asset manager will invariably do very similar things with it, regardless of whether it's a behemoth like BlackRock or a much smaller asset manager. They're going to be taking that capital and they're going to be putting that into the world's stock markets. So of course, if you're in the US, you'll be familiar with the New York Stock Exchange. You may be familiar with the NASDAQ. And so these are places where when a company wants to raise money, or owners of a private company want to sell their company and make a profit on the initial time investment that they've made to build that company up, they can go to those markets and they can sell shares in their company. So this is a very simple concept. You have a company and it is owned by private investors and then you float it on the stock market, and now anyone in the world who has access to that market via a brokerage account can go in and buy those shares. And the idea is, of course, that over time that company becomes worth more, it gets more profit, distributes that profit in the form of dividends to its investors, and those shares become more valuable, more desirable by other people. There's competition for them, and so the price rises in the market. So that's equity investing. The other main form of investing is to lend money. The idea with lending money is, of course, if you have $100 to lend to someone, you're going to want that capital to appreciate, so you will charge them interest on it. And so whether you lend your friend $100 and ask them to pay you back $110, which would give, you know, over that period a 10% return on the investment, or whether you're lending $1 billion to IBM to facilitate some sort of capital investment into their business to, you know, build a new division or to go and build Watson or whatever it happens to be that they need capital for, you are lending a fixed amount of money for a fixed amount of return. And so there's various terms that are bandied about when it comes to fixed income investing. But again, when you boil it all down, it's money being lent to another party and that party agreeing to pay the lender a fixed amount of money over the period of the investment. Now, there's lots of ways in which fixed income investments vary, and there's lots of things around fixed income investing that you'll hear. But you'll hear things like coupon payments, interest payments, etc. Really, there's two main elements. How much is being invested for a particular return, so the interest rate, and then the period over which that's being invested. So when you get a mortgage, you'll be aware of the interest rate. You'll be aware of the fact that the longer you borrow that money over, the more you're going to end up paying back. So these are the kind of the core elements. And it's certain. So it tends to be something that people think of as being a relatively less risky investing style than equity, because there's no guarantee with equity. As we've seen with some IPOs over the last few years, sometimes firms will go to market, will float on the stock exchange, and immediately those people who have been participated in that IPO are actually now holding equity that's worth less because the market disagreed with their assessment of how valuable the company was. And so they're very, very different investing styles. But at the core of it, those are the two main investing styles. There are other investing or ways of investing capital. Commodities is one of them. Slightly different because, of course, commodities are things like oil, steel, lean hogs, things that you can touch and take delivery of and then do things with in the world. And, of course, lots of businesses out in the world need these commodities in order to operate, in order to build your iPhone. Foxconn, the company that makes the device for Apple, needs to take delivery of a certain amount of cobalt and lithium in order to make the various components, or indeed more likely the various other vendors in their supply chain who make the batteries and other components need to take delivery of those commodities. And so commodities are not like fixed income or equities in the sense that really it's just like buying a thing. But of course, because of the laws of supply and demand, certain types of commodities are subject to problems in their supply chain. So, again, being in the time of the world that we are, you may, if you're listening to this in kind of the 2020 time frame, you will of course remember what happened to the price of oil. But if you aren't, you can go back and look and see what happened to the price of oil in March 2020. There was a lot of supply of oil, and there wasn't very much demand because people weren't able to drive their cars around. So there was an excess of oil, but the oil had to go somewhere because it was being pumped out of the ground. And so we had to go into storage somewhere. Very few people have the storage. So the price went negative, which very few people in the world, apart from commodity experts, realised was actually even possible, because people were paying people to take their oil off their hands because they didn't have anywhere to put it. So commodities are different in the sense that they are physical delivery of goods. But of course, if you have a business, like a very good example of this is a confectionery business. So a business like Mars or Nestle, people who need to, Mars is not a business, Nestle is a business, people who need to take cocoa to make confectionery, they need to take delivery of that cocoa. If they can't secure that cocoa for a reasonable price, then of course the price of your chocolate is going to go up. And the same thing exists for, you know, coffee for producers and anyone who's using a raw good to make a derived good from it. They need to ensure that is locked in at a certain price so that they make sure that they aren't having to massively up the cost of their goods, and then obviously that would reduce demand. But of course things like cocoa are susceptible to things like the weather patterns changing. So if you have a drought in a harvest period, then you may well not have as much of that particular crop to harvest in that period, and therefore there will be less of it, and there will be the same amount of demand, and so people will start bidding the price up, and then eventually you get to a point where in order to get the amount of cocoa you need, you have to pay a lot more, and therefore that's then passed on to the consumer. So these variations in supply and demand that are subject to all sorts of real world things happening, you know, fungus growing on bananas, you name it can happen, and therefore there exists exchanges where you can lock in the future price of these commodities, commodity futures, and people will of course, if you are a purveyor of chocolate goods, you are going to want to lock in the price as much as possible of your cocoa in the future, so you can have certainty and have a level of insurance around being able to receive those goods at that point in the future. And so that's why we have these what we call derivatives futures, which allow them to kind of hedge that risk, is what the term is. But of course, who are they hedging it with? Who's agreeing to pay? Who's provide these things? But of course, it's the providers of these commodities who also want to have assurance around the price. But then in the middle, you have speculators, people who will come in and provide liquidity to the market, where perhaps there isn't as much risk appetite on either side of the equation, but a smart person in the middle who, you know, some hedge funds as an example, which we would get onto in another session, will come in. And I know of hedge funds who have weather stations all around the world in order to understand weather patterns across various different growing regions and try to understand more than the actual confectioner or the provider of the cocoa in this particular example, and will attempt to make money by buying those contracts or selling those contracts, and then hopefully making a profit when they come to expiry. And so there are lots of other ways to make money, but at the end of the day, it's speculation. It really comes down to the amount of risk that you're taking. And so across these three main asset classes, you find that there are lots and lots of different ways to make money in different markets, different stock exchanges around the world, different ways of lending money, different derivatives on top of these different instruments. Again, going back in time to 2008, one of the main ways that people like the hedge fund Paulson made money was by taking out what's called a credit default swap on tranches of loans that were backed by mortgages. And they had done their research to find that a lot of the people who'd been given mortgages wouldn't be able to pay them, given certain rate conditions. And in actual fact, when those conditions came to pass, they knew that those organisations, those people were going to be in a place where they couldn't afford to pay their mortgages, and therefore the people who were on the kind of the other end of them were going to also default. And so they started to take out credit default swaps, effectively insurance on these organisations like Lehman Brothers going bust. And effectively those contracts, on the one side is the person who's buying the insurance, so as if you were insuring your house, and the other side is the person who's selling the insurance, like the insurance company. And if the house burns down, then you make money. And in this case, the house burning down was the entity, like Lehman Brothers, going bust. But of course, the slightly weird situation was that the person taking out the insurance policy didn't own the house. There was no ownership of Lehman Brothers by the person taking out the credit default swap. So these derivatives are there to help people spread risk. And in some cases, people use them for speculation. And so this is a vast oversimplification of how people invest money. But that is what the asset management industry does. Now, the asset management industry itself is broken up into different types of companies that invest in different ways. The long-only industry, or the mutual fund industry, as it's known, is a pretty large industry. It's about 2,500 companies worldwide that engage in this style of investing. When someone says long-only or mutual fund investing, what they're really saying is a regulated style of investing that is fronted by what we term as a fund that most people can invest into without having to have too much sophistication, and a style of investing that is generally considered to be perhaps lacking the type of tail risk, as we might term it, of a private investing style alternative that we'll get onto in a minute, the kind of thing that is suitable for someone to put their pension money into, as an example. And so that makes up most of the assets, or the asset allocation of the world. Most common style of investing, index funds are the most common style of investing for lots of entities, meaning that they invest into the same companies as a stock market index. Again, drilling down into the mutual fund or the long-only industry requires a session on its own, but it's the most common style of investing. Below that, you have what are termed as hedge funds, which are also known as alternative investments. The term in Europe is AIFs, alternative investment funds. But these do slightly more risky style of investment, or rather, probably more, better termed as more sophisticated styles of investment, and they use typically more of those derivative style instruments to try to make money in more exotic ways. The kind of ways that require a deeper understanding of economics, deeper understanding of the financial markets, and the kind of thing that if you were the average Joe on the street, you might not be capable of understanding the risks of. And therefore, they tend to be restricted away from normal, everyday investors from investing into. The Madoff debacle is a really good example of why normal people shouldn't invest into alternative investment vehicles, because they're lightly regulated. They do not have the same oversight from regulatory bodies as long-only funds, mutual funds, and therefore they tend to be used by the more sophisticated investors. Institutional investors certainly use them, but of course they do a lot of due diligence on those funds, and they only select the ones that are most suitable for the deployment of capital, and they are considered to have the right level of sophistication to use them. They can have very, very high returns, much, much higher than you would get from a stock market investment, but of course they come with potential risks as well. So those are the two main ways of investing into publicly traded investments. There are also ETFs, which you can buy, which are exchange-traded funds, generally run by the same asset managers that run mutual funds. And in actual fact, you will find that some mutual fund managers have hedge fund products as well. But ETFs tend to be much lower cost than a mutual fund. So mutual fund industry has certainly seen some change over the last 10 years since ETFs were introduced. But an ETF is a passively managed vehicle, sometimes managed by computers, that seeks to achieve a particular investing style, but it's not always run by a human being. It's sometimes rebalanced using programmatic trading models, and therefore the idea that it's cheaper. And so this passive style of investing has seen a lot of price compression in terms of how much you have to pay to get access to sophisticated investments in the recent years, and it's definitely caused a lot of our customers to think about how much they're spending on doing things like producing fact sheets, because of course they can't afford to have the people in their organisations doing them, which we will cover later on, are very expensive. And of course, you've also got the option of just investing into these instruments yourself. But of course, most people don't do that because it requires you to really understand what's going on in these companies. And that's actually what you're outsourcing to the asset manager, the understanding of what is going on within these firms, how to best get access to these returns, how to do that in the riskiest or the least risky way. And so for that, of course, you're paying fees. Now, when you go beyond the sort of the mutual fund ETF or hedge fund space, you start to get into other types of private investing style, which are broadly private equity and venture capital. These are, again, like hedge funds, only really accessible to investors with a level of sophistication, a level of capital behind them, because, again, they can have a lot of risk. Venture capital investing is investment into early stage private companies generally, or at least companies that have gone past their seed rounds, as it's called. And again, the risk inherent in these companies is not around perhaps an asymmetric risk function, which would basically mean something like with a hedge fund that they're gambling at the high stakes tables. And more about the fact that your capital is being deployed to early stage companies which have a high chance of going out of business. But of course, the reward for your risk is that at some point you may stumble upon a Facebook or a Google, one of these unicorn companies that will return many hundreds, if not thousands, of times your money, which is a pretty nice thing to happen. But of course, along the way, you may find some investments like Theranos that purport to be unicorns, but in fact are not, and end up losing all of their money. So again, it requires a certain level of sophistication. The fee structures are different. How you invest is different, in the sense that you will agree to commit capital to these funds, and then as the fund manager finds the investment opportunities, they will call upon that capital and deploy it. And you are locked up. Unless you find a secondary market for your investment, you are locked up, your capital is locked up until that investment exits, until they find someone to sell that company to, either to the stock market and to the end investor, or to another private investor. And that is kind of how private equity works, except for private equity, the kind of the goal of the investment is very different. With venture investing, they're looking for the next. So they're looking out for the types of companies that are going to disrupt industries and get in on the ground floor and are really going to change the way the world works. Whereas with private equity, they're sometimes not looking for that. Sometimes they are looking for those unicorns, but other times they're also looking for businesses that are badly managed, that have the ability to have costs taken out of them. And by taking out that cost, they create margin and therefore a greater valuation. Sometimes they're looking for businesses that can be combined with other businesses to create synergies within them. And there are lots of different ways that private equity firms will create value, but invariably they are investing in later stage companies and are operating them in a very different way to a venture board. So the way that they invest is similar. They take capital commitments, and then when they find the opportunities, they ask the investors to give them the money. They go and invest, and again, you're locked up until those investments exit. So whilst there are lots of other ways to invest money within the world, these are the main styles and the main ways that our customers will deploy the money that's given to them. And so the asset management industry is, of course, made up of these mutual fund managers who also have ETFs, hedge fund managers, VCs, and private equity firms. Now, we do provide solutions to pretty much all of these types of firms, but right now, we're very much focused on the core mutual fund industry. And we'll come on to later why that is. Now, to flip it around, where does the money come from? That's a very, very important thing to understand, because, of course, we've talked about how the money is deployed, but how does it get into the hands of the people who deploy it? So the first thing to understand is that there are legal structures that all of these companies construct for their funds, the pots of money that get deployed into these various securities. So they do vary based on the type of fund manager that you're dealing with. And they also vary based on the regulatory regime. And depending on the type of country where these fund managers are based or selling their products, different regulatory constructs are used. But generally speaking, you have something which is notionally known as a fund. Sometimes you'll hear it termed a share class. But effectively, it's an account where capital is deployed from the kind of the end investor's pot of money to a place where the fund manager can invest it. Now, in the mutual fund industry, you'll see that this is most commonly done using share classes, which indicate that really what you're doing is buying shares of something. There's lots of different types of funds. There's closed-end funds, there's open-end funds. But to simplify things for the purposes of this initial talk, the end investor is buying shares in a fund. This is true for most mutual fund constructs in the world. In the European Union, we have something called UCITS, Undertaking for Collective Investments in Transferable Securities Regulation, first of which I think was late 80s, early 90s. Although I could be wrong about that, so I walk around my garden. But the idea there was, as the European Union came together, which of course the idea of the European Union was to break down borders between different countries and states and doing trade with each other and to create a unified Europe, they wanted to allow asset managers in different parts of Europe to sell their products to other European citizens. So that's what UCITS was about. It was about creating safe, common regulatory constructs to govern these vehicles so that those funds could be sold across borders. In the US, you have the 40 Act. So sometimes you'll hear funds, mutual funds called 40 Act funds. And so there were various acts, 33 Act, 40 Act, which were put in place in order to allow the creation of these mutual fund constructs so that someone who kind of knew how to put money to work in the stock market or in fixed income instruments could take investments from outside investors, and those investors could know that they had certain protections. And so these mutual fund regulatory constructs are really, really important to understand. Different parts of the world, they have different regimes, but the 40 Act funds and UCITS are two of the main ones that you will come across. UCITS is a whole other kettle of fish on its own, which probably requires another session. But the thing that's common between both US mutual funds and European mutual funds is, again, the use of share classes and shares. So effectively, when you invest into one of these funds, your capital flows via a transfer agent, your money is transferred, ROI transfer, and you receive shares in those funds. And those funds have a value on those shares. And the value on those shares is based on the value of the underlying instruments that they invest into. If you transfer $100 into a mutual fund and you get a share back, and it's worth $100, and those $100 are put into Facebook, tomorrow when Facebook goes up in price, the value of that fund will go up in price. And so, of course, you will also pay the fund for the pleasure of having that return. So you will pay an initial entry charge, potentially. You will pay an ongoing charge for the management of that capital. And so this is also known as a load, but it effectively represents the amount of fee that you're going to pay to have your money invested on your behalf, all the work that the fund manager is doing for you to try to achieve that return. Of course, it's not free. We can't just expect to stick our money into things and have the value go up without someone doing some work. So that's the way that we compensate them for that. There are actually different types of share classes for each fund. So as you might appreciate in life in general, if you buy more of something, sometimes you get a better price because the person who's selling it has to do less work to acquire effectively the same value of customer. You know, instead of selling one sprocket to 100 people, which of course will cost them money to market to and to manage, they can sell 100 to one person. So it makes it cheaper for them. And so mutual fund managers are the same. They offer bulk discounts. And so if you happen to have $1 billion or $100 billion, they're going to charge you a lot less than they would someone who is perhaps only going to invest $100. But of course, they want to have a broad distribution of different types of customers to capture as many assets as they can. And so different share classes will offer different fees. They will also offer different types of terms as well. This is particularly true when you get into hedge funds and lockups. But different fees associated with different share classes are important. And in the European Union as well, because of the number of countries, certain share classes are registered in different states, because it may be true that BBVA, which is a Spanish asset manager, is well known to Spanish institutions, and therefore they sell a lot of their mutual fund products to the pension funds of Spanish companies. But in France, perhaps there isn't such an affinity for BBVA products, and therefore they actually don't want to sell those products there. So in Europe, it becomes even more complicated because, unlike in the US, where the suitability of a product is just determined by who's buying it and how much money have they got, in the European Union, that's slightly different because you just may not be able to buy it in a particular state if they haven't registered it there. And that's an important part of the UCITS regulations, is governing which products are for sale in which region and what kind of things people need to do in order to sell them. So, of course, this is how the money makes the final leap from one bank account to another. But again, where does it come from? So, ultimately, the answer is it comes from every single person on this planet. So, whether you have saved £100 in your bank account and you're leaving it there accruing interest, or you are the person who's managing a pension plan, a corporate pension plan, for a large blue chip company, or even for some form of governmental or state entity. Ultimately, that money is the claim of that money flows back to an individual. Sometimes it actually flows back to a corporate entity because it's the proceeds of a business, the profit of a business being reinvested. But most of the time it's coming from us. And so how does it get there? So in most states around the world, the predominant way of capital being invested from a person is going to be via a bank. So in the UK here, you can go into your bank's website, click around, and eventually you find investments. You can actually invest through the bank. In some states, you can go into the bank. In Europe, this is common. And you can talk to an advisor in the bank, and then they will do it for you within the bank. In other markets, in fact, this is more common in the UK, they will have financial advisors. So we call them IFAs here. In the US, they call them RIAs, Registered Investment Advisors. And these are people who are dispersed throughout the country. They sometimes work for larger broker-dealers like Merrill Lynch. Sometimes they're independent. These are the kind of people who will actually sit down with the individual and not just offer the ability to take their money and put it into a fund, but also to do planning with them around their financial situation. So that could be tax planning. It could be estate planning. It could be all sorts of other financial services that are attuned to the needs of that individual person. But that is one of the main ways, through an advisor, that capital flows into these funds. And it's very, very important. And you will find that most purveyors of fund products are very, very focused on how they service advisors. There's lots of them. They don't all write huge checks, but there's so many of them, and they are such an effective way of gathering the tail of assets in the world, that making sure that advisors can sell your products is very, very important. The other main way is via an institution. So an institution would be a corporate pension plan, as an example. It could also be the endowment of a university, the investment office of, say, Cornell University, as a good example. And these entities are typically taking much, much larger sums of money, definitely in the billions of dollars usually, and they're investing it on behalf of the entity itself. So in the case of Cornell University, they're taking the proceeds of both their other investment activities, so perhaps property investment, but obviously more commonly it's the proceeds of fees that are flowing into the university for tuition that is perhaps excess from the amount of money that is invested into new buildings and into paying staff and all those sorts of things. So they're investing on behalf of the entity. Corporate pension plan is investing generally on behalf of the workers. Or a state pension plan might be investing on behalf of the state workers. So one of the largest plans in the world, I think, last time I looked, it was the largest, is CalPERS, the California Public Employee Retirement System. And that's investing the proceeds of firefighters, police officers, other state employees, and in some cases you actually have individual investment offices that invest on behalf of individual types of workers, like Texas teachers is a really important one, who invest the pension part of teachers in the state of Texas. And so these entities tend to be a bit more sophisticated because they have a bit more money to employ chief investment officers that understand the markets and understand asset allocation and understand planning for the future. And they're very, very important because, of course, one of the things that can quickly cause society to fall apart is when people don't have enough money to retire, because that means they have to work late in their lives. Perhaps they can't work later in their lives. They can become destitute. Taking care of our elderly is a very, very important thing. And so, of course, making sure that money is invested effectively is why they take such care and attention in doing so. Now, there is a channel called retail, which is the end investor themselves deploying capital. It's not as common as the first two, because it's a very sophisticated activity. And so gaining a capital allocation from an institutional investor or from an advisory network is the most two common channels. There are other types of institution as well. There are other people involved in the conversations. For instance, with institutions, it's very common for them to retain consultants to help them with their asset allocation work. How much money should be put into a certain asset class? Which are the best funds? Doing all that analysis. And so there are groups like Cambridge Associates, a really good example of them in the US, do a lot of work with institutions to help them to understand which are the best funds to invest into, which are the least risky, and to do the kind of economic analysis that they may not have the ability to do in-house. So another important player. But again, when we rewind to what we were talking about earlier, we have capital coming from, a lot of the time, individual people in the world or institutions being deployed into these funds, in return for shares in these funds. The money then is put to work in the stock market in shares of company equity, lent to companies in the form of bonds, is another term for a loan. And of course, with the goal over time of that money being worth more and being redeemed. So this is the kind of the when you zoom out, this is the big picture of the investment industry worldwide. Now, when you actually zoom in and you look at the micro, you will find lots of other nuances to it. So, for example, if you are one of the largest mutual fund managers in the world, Wellington being a really, really good example, approximately $1 trillion under management, a very good brand name in the industry, well-known in alternatives, well-known in the mutual fund industry, well-known in the separately managed account industry, which is another kind of offshoot of the mutual fund industry where instead of investing alongside other people, you get your own kind of private account, which for risk reasons is important. They need to get the most broad distribution as possible. They want their product to be bought by as many people as possible. But if you take the United States as a really good example, and there's certainly a parallel in Europe, the money is coming from people in some cases Arkansas or Austin, Texas, Palo Alto. It is impossible for Wellington to have offices in those places. And that's why we have advisors, because advisors tend to be either nationwide or local entities, but if they're nationwide, people like Merrill Lynch, they have offices in those locations. So they are the feeders, if you will, of this capital. And it would be impossible for Wellington to start up offices in all those places. So then you understand why do advisors exist, because fund managers are good at managing money. They're not necessarily good at building relationships with individuals and doing estate planning and all the other kind of things that an advisor needs to do. So you understand now why financial advisor is so important. But of course, for that fund manager, they need to make sure that they're servicing the needs of those clients. In fact, the advisors or the broker-dealers who employ the advisors are their very, very important clients, and they need to be sold to. So, of course, the asset manager also has salespeople. They tend to be called wholesalers in the US. There are different types of wholesalers. There are some that sit behind the desk. There are some that go out and visit with customers. There are classes of wholesalers that will deal with advisory institutions or advisors in general. And there are classes of wholesalers that will deal with institutions. These wholesalers are the people who need to go out and make sure that the advisory, the broker-dealer entities in the US are taking their products and pushing them to their customers, that they are top of mind, top of shelf, or prime place on the shelf when talking to their customers. So these salespeople who work at these asset managers are very, very important. In Europe, it's the same, because, of course, it's even, actually, the fragmentation is even worse in Europe, because, of course, we have the same or a similar geographic area to deal with, but of course you have then the added challenge of culture. So selling to German people is very different to selling to French people, yet they are separated by a contiguous border, and therefore you can step across the border and it becomes very, very challenging to sell where it was very, very easy on the other side because you spoke German and now you don't speak French. So it's a very churlish example, but
you see how the cultural difference makes it harder. So in Europe, again, asset managers are trying to achieve cross-border distribution, but they need local distribution options. Very good example of this is Nordea. Nordea, probably, I would say top 50 in terms of asset managers, probably about 300 billion under management, Danish asset manager, one of the best performing asset managers in terms of new asset growth in Europe, a pioneer of ESG investing, which of course environmental, social, and governance-based investing. But they're sold in Europe by the John Hancock network. They're sold in different European countries by different bank assurance firms. And they need this because, of course, it just becomes very, very challenging to deal with your customers if you're having to employ people that speak different languages and so on and so forth. So, again, the notion of these advisory networks is critical to the distribution of product. And the salespeople within your firms who cover them, again, are critical. So, a wise person once told me, in the asset management industry, you don't get rich through performance. You get rich through gathering assets. And that is so true. Now, you kind of need performance of some sort in order to gather assets. But it's not the only thing. There are many, many things. And those many, many things need to be have their virtues espoused by the salespeople. So to call them the rainmakers, it's probably a good thing to call them, but they're very, very important. And you will find that they are revered within all of our clients, regardless of whether you're talking about an IR person in a hedge fund, an investor relations person, tend to be what they call, salespeople are called, or a wholesaler in a mutual fund, or when you get into venture, a partner at a venture firm. These are the people that make the money flow in, and you need to support them. And it's not just them you need to support. You need to support the people who are also making those buying decisions. So the advisors themselves, because they're selling your products as well. And even consultants, you need to support them because they're going to be advising the institutions. And you may need to support the analysts at the institution in making decisions about your products. And if there's one thing you should take away from this initial overview, is that these products are pretty complicated. Yes, they're based on these very simplistic, when you take a step back and you look at them, equity, fixed income, commodities, but there are many, many ways in which they are devilishly intricate, and the way that they are then therefore differentiated from the competition is also very challenging. And so I'm not sure of any product in the world that has as much technical variation than financial services, and in particular investment products. And so whilst the purveyors of these products are also very smart and sophisticated, they need to be supported and enabled. And so they are enabled with data and information and content. Good example. If you're an advisor and you're going out to visit your customers and you're going to advise them on which one of your new emerging market equity funds that the entity that you belong to has on its shelf, because of course you can't sell every fund in the world. You have to have a relationship. Good example is St. James's Place, an advisor in the UK, has an IFA network in the UK. They can't sell everyone's funds. They have to choose which funds to invest into. And they actually have a fund selection team that will do that. But you will have a shelf. It's called a shelf. Have a number of these funds that you are able to sell to your end client. Every single month, which is the common period of reporting here in Europe, you're going to go out, potentially every quarter, and you're going to go and talk to your customers about the types of products that you may have to fulfill a need in their investment portfolio. And part of your chief economist's view is that emerging market equity is an allocation that most people of a certain age and return goal need to have in their portfolio. I mean, you have three or four options. Let's say that two of those options provide you with some sales collateral, but they always provide it on the 15th of the month, and the other two provide it on the 5th. You go out into the world, and from the 5th onwards, you're talking about those two managers that have provided you that up-to-date information. And particularly, a good example would be the period we've just been through here. You're talking about what's happening right now. It's very important. You may be getting their investment review where their portfolio managers talked about how they view the markets changing over the next couple of months. And you may not have that on the other two. Let me tell you that the two that have not provided the content will not be getting sold, at least at the same rate as the other two. That content is critical to enable that advisor to have an educated conversation with their customers. And a fact sheet is a relatively simplistic piece of content. It's got performance on it, it's got some asset allocation information on it, meaning, you know, performance meaning how much money has it made over different periods, expressed in different types of percentages. Asset allocation meaning, you know, how was the money broken down within the fund into different, you know, kind of sub-aggregations of different things like sectors. So how much of the money is in automotive, how much of it is in China, etc., etc. And so that information is obviously critical to backing up a story about why it's suitable for an asset allocation. You know, well, we think, you know, China's middle class growing, they're going to invest a lot in cars, and therefore, you know, we think Geely's a really great investment, and that's why we've put the money into it in this fund. It allows them to tell that story. And that is the fuel for the fire of the sale. It is also the case that, of course, they may want this information digitally. So they may be having a conversation with the customer and they may say, oh, well, how does that compare to some of your other products in your stable? You know, perhaps, you know, a global equity fund, because that should have that allocation in it too. Oh, well, let's just go look it up on the website and let's compare the performance. Can they actually do these things? Are they enabled to do these things? Are your wholesalers enabled to have those conversations with the fund selection teams that they're facing off with? So, You see how these funds and all the information that they produce about how the capital is being deployed, the thought leadership behind it, is so very, very important to everyone in that chain of what we call distribution. And so to bring this all back to what we do, we help those asset management entities to take the information, the thought leadership, the content, and to put it in the hands of the people who are making the investment decisions or making the case for the investment decisions, the salespeople or the investors, as quickly and as usefully as is humanly possible. And we have pioneered ways of doing this that are much, much faster and much, much more effective than these companies could do on their own. They are much cheaper than they could do on their own as well. And so our value to these organizations is primarily in supporting the distribution of their product. It is secondarily supporting the retention of assets within their funds. And our unique value proposition, selling point, however you would like to term that, is that we do that in a much more effective way through the use of our proprietary software. The content that you create will be more engaging. The content you create will be in the hands of those salespeople faster. The content that you create will be unleashed digitally through engaging websites and portals. And this will all be done at a cost much lower than these firms could do it, because the dirty secret is that for most of these entities, their average headcount cost is upwards of $200,000 a year when you account for all of their fancy offices and all of the other overheads that they have. And so whenever they try to do something like, a very good example is sales presentations. They take the charts and the tables and the data that they put into their fact sheets and they put it into a deck because they want to tell a story. So they have these decks and they are incredibly unautomated. They have very large teams of people making these materials, and they don't have any automation. If they have a team of 10 people, probably costing them $2 million a year to support it. If your software can reduce that by two heads redeployed to other high-value activities, you've saved them $400,000. If you can redeploy half of them, it's $1 million. When you get into DXM, which is, of course, the part of our platform that helps them build these portals or websites, the costs are even greater because developers are, first of all, quite hard to find, good ones, Again, they're expensive. You need a lot of them to kind of do the kind of things that we do. So again, the headcount equivalent of our solution is a very strong ROI driver. Here's a good example. On every asset management website in the world, there will be a fund center. That's the thing that I referred to when I gave the example of someone requesting a performance comparison. You can go in there, it's a little bit like an online shopping experience for other types of products like Amazon, but it's got funds in it. And you can rank and you can compare and, you know, you can drill in, you can see the different merits of the products. Typically, it will take about 12 to 18 months to build with a team of 5 people. So 5 people for a year, it's going to cost you $200,000, $1 million. So you're talking $1.5 million to build that. Now, with our platform, of course, you have our license, which you guys will become familiar with the pricing of. But only in very, very rare cases will that price get anywhere near to $1.5 million. And, of course, the other benefit is that it will be delivered much, much more quickly. And that is a truism across every single thing that we do. The speed to value, or the time to value of our solution, is much, much, much lower because it's all built. It just needs to be configured. So not only are the dollar costs lower, but the time to value is much, much sooner. And what that means is that the benefits that the salespeople are going to receive happen sooner, and therefore their effectiveness goes up sooner, and they are able to gather more assets. So as a concept for those of you who have done economics or have worked in the financial services industry, which is the time value of money. And nowhere is that more applicable than when we're talking about the asset management industry, because the more assets you can gather sooner, the more time you have to gather fees on them. And so if you can get an investment from someone even 1 month sooner, you are getting money you would never ever get, because you can only accrue fees over time in the asset management industry. So the sooner you have the assets, the longer you have them for, the more money you make. And so that's why we also focus on not just servicing the salespeople, but servicing the client service and client reporting things. Because the service that you give to your customers, as you will all know from every single business in the world, is a key determinant of whether they will continue to be a customer of yours. How well do you communicate in a crisis? How much transparency do you give them? How easy do you make it to interact with you as a business? How much of a partner are you? How flexible are you? Of course, again, a lot of the information that you provide to your customers is the same, if not more, in terms of volume and density than you give to your prospects. And so how that is consumed by them, how quickly they receive it, how quickly they can use it to do their own analysis and to do their own reporting is another critical part of that customer service and customer success journey within an asset management organization. So again, if you're taking a team of 10 people to build client reports manually and it takes you 6 weeks versus 1 week, that 5 week delta for your customers is huge. Getting information 5 weeks sooner, can you imagine that waiting at the end of a quarter to be told how much money was made or to get the kind of the input that you need to put into your board presentation? And so again, when you zoom back out, really what we are doing is helping at the very, very sharp end of this asset management industry globally to facilitate the quicker flow of assets, the retention of those assets for longer, and the overall effectiveness of these distribution organizations. So that is our place in the world. I think in future sessions, we're going to talk about the different personas that are involved in these organizations and who we work with, and how they think about our solution, the problems that they have on the shop floor. But this has been the first session. I hope you enjoyed it, and we will follow up with the next one soon.